afternoon. You are joining We the People Radio for another, episode. Oh.
Uh-oh. Am I on?
We're on, Roth.
Mic check.
We don't leave time for a mic check. That takes all the fun out of it.
I know it.
Oh, my gosh. So I'm Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
There you go. And it's not material other than if you want to blame someone. We only gave you that information for possible blaming at a later date.
And there will be blaming.
Of course there will be.
Yes. but we only stop until somebody's crying.
Right.
That's right.
But we keep getting sick, so you can't tell which one of us is which because we all sound like men now.
Well, I think I'm still a man. I hope I'm still there.
Yeah, but sometimes I have to sound like a man.
Oh, I got you.
Like,
all right.
I called customer support, and the guy's like, yes, sir. Not only is he speaking to me in an accent, but he keeps calling me sir. It's like, I'm a man. Anyway, so thanks to our sponsor.
Powerhouse Solar.
There you go.
Yeah.
And get there.
You need solar assistance, get a hold of Bruce or Sue over there. They'll take good care of you.
Our local company. Been around for 12 years. They know stuff. They'll be here. So the fly-by-night guys that roll in with the, hey, you want to rent your roof to us or whatever, whatever they're up to.
Stay away from that.
Yeah, don't do that.
Call local.
Call Bruce and Sue. we have a really interesting continuation. We have not talked to William Kay since it was a year ago. It was February 2015.
Yeah.
I keep forgetting we're in 2017. We haven't talked to him in 2 years, but he sent me this great video where he was kind of just shredding the whole Paris climate talks and what they're all up to. And I thought, oh, we must have him on again. It just so in keeping with our theme of late. So you can find all of his information. You can find all of his information at ecofascism.com. We've got all his stuff linked and videos and things like that because we haven't had video in previous interviews. We have not had video from him. We've only had audio things. So his videos are linked at wethepeopleradio.us.
There you have it.
Okay, that's all the homework. William, are you hiding in there in the phone?
I am. I'm in the phone.
As our hostage?
Yeah.
How's it going, William?
Very well. It's warm now in Edmonton, Alberta.
Oh, wow.
We just went through a terrible cold snap. It was below 20 below Celsius, which is below 5 Fahrenheit.
Yeah, that's too
below
cold
zero,
for me.
Like for a good solid week and a half.
Yeah, we actually got some of that down here as well. I mean, we actually got snow in Redding, which is a little bit unusual, but
Well, that's good news for you guys
because
you were short of water. So
yep.
No, we're still going to be short of water. Are you kidding me? They've decided that they need to run it all out through the Delta. They're busy blowing it to the ocean.
We're in permadrought. Yeah, they don't want to let that go.
We don't want to have any water by the time all this extra water gets done coming down. So,
well, if you need water, you talk to us up in Canada. We have 10% of the world's supply of fresh water.
Wow.
And we've got more water pouring into the Arctic Ocean than California could consume in a millennia.
Oh, we need to build a pipeline. Oh, no, that doesn't go over very well either,
actually,
does it?
If you go on my website, there's a lengthy collection of articles called The Great Wahapa Project, because in the 1960s there was a lot of talk about using river diversions, et cetera, to get some of these northern rivers diverted down into the U.S. Southwest. You know, there was engineering firms that had complete blueprints of that. It was doable and economically doable in the 1960s. With today's technology, be a lead pipe cinch. But always been kicked around. You know, major water diversion projects like Canada, particularly northern Canada, has got enormous water resources that are not being used at all. Just north of here, there's a river that's actually larger than the Rhine River in Europe, and 4 villages live along it, 10,000 people. Whereas the Rhine River has got 50 cities living along it.
Wow.
And that river flows into the Arctic Ocean. Mm. Nobody's using that water at all.
Well, I've always wondered why, you know, every year you have all these major floods and everything going on in the east, and then we have a drought out here. Got a big, great big pipe would just really solve a lot of that. And it can't be that expensive.
That's been kicked around for a long time. The environmentalists have blocked all of that talk.
Well, they put
If you're east of the Mississippi, there's too much water. West of the Mississippi, not so much.
Right, Right. And you know, they put these big fiber optic lines all over the place, and there's always somebody digging a big trench and filling it back in. That's really not that technical to dig a trench, put a pipe in it, and cover it up.
And you don't have to worry about the pipe breaking. I mean, it isn't like it's poisoning some field. It's like water on the ground, right? So there's no great environmental catastrophe.
Oh, come on.
You haven't
been to California lately.
Yeah, you put water on the ground where it doesn't belong, and you are in big trouble.
We can turn any substance into an environmental catastrophe.
That's right, because once you put the water on the ground, now you got fairy shrimp. Now you can't get rid of the water.
Yeah,
now
but my favorite was when they dug out the Shasta Lake. They were digging new footings for a different bridge. They were changing the bridge over. They dug out the footings. Well, so instead of taking the lake bottom, the dirt and whatever, I don't know, it's probably just mud. Instead of taking that and just putting it in a different place in the lake, they had to haul it away as toxic waste.
Yeah, because it was in the water to start with.
It was in the lake. You couldn't just move it over.
Yeah. Well, they obviously know much more about that.
And you know, when the tsunami came, I got another one. When the tsunami came over in Crescent City, in order to recover their harbor, obviously the harbor got,
filled back in with sand.
Right. So instead of taking that and putting it back out toward the ocean or somewhere like that, no, they had to haul that away as toxic waste too.
Yeah.
Put it in a landfill.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's too toxic. You got to spend extra.
Because, if California, continues to do this, the entire planet's going to benefit. You know, we're going to change the ecosystem of the whole planet. So you got to do your homework, William. You got to figure out what we're doing
here. Landscaping,
Yeah. So,
so you've been hammering the Paris Accord and the I forget what you called it, the climate industrial complex, which I thought was it was a fun new term. I liked it a lot. Where would you like to begin?
Well, if you want to bring this right up to speed, there's a real Russian angle to this. You've noticed that Russia is in the news a lot lately.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well. Back in 2012, President-elect Donald Trump, as he then was, made a tweet where he's sometimes backtracking this, but he more or less said that he thought that global warming was a Chinese hoax. On several occasions, he's called it a hoax. He's right. I wouldn't use the word hoax. I would use the word economic warfare. And I don't really blame the Chinese. They certainly slithered their way into this in a way that would cause them no harm. But the people who are really responsible for the global warming economic warfare campaign are the Europeans. It is the EU. These are the countries that were on the ground floor of this project. They are the ones who have devoted far more resources to renewable energies and the like. Than any other country in the world. This is really a campaign unquestionably driven by our allies in Berlin. With Donald Trump being elected, in all likelihood, America's climate policies are going to shift dramatically. He's got four or five people in the cabinet, and I can name them, who've already gone on record, being climate contrarians or what I like to call climate realists. The bottom line is this. If America drops cooperation with climate change, climate activism, their relationship with Europe will deteriorate very rapidly. And it ties into Russian relations because Putin has also made a number of remarks indicating that he doesn't believe in climate change. Russia, like the United States, is a natural energy superpower. They have tremendous coal, oil, and gas reserves, like Russia, like Canada. You cannot say that of the European Union.
That's true.
The reason why climate makes sense to the Europeans is because they are trying to achieve European energy independence. This is the EU imports, by last count, almost $600 billion a year of fossil fuels into the EU. They are hemorrhaging enormous amounts of money, and most of that money is going to their longtime rivals and adversaries, the Russians, the Arabs, what have you.
Because they don't have the fossil fuels, is that correct?
They simply do not have any oil in the ground.
Right.
They've got a little bit of coal here and there, no natural gas. Most of the countries in Europe are importing 100% of their fossil fuels. That is not our problem in North America.
Amen.
This is their problem. And what I tried to point out in that paper on the climate, on the Paris climate change, if you look at the history of global warming, you go back to the OPEC crisis of the 70s. At that time, the leading governments of Europe were issuing public statements and, you know, they formed the IEA and a bunch of other organizations where they very explicitly said, we have to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels. We have to start transitioning towards renewable energies. Those statements were coming out in the mid-1970s. The climate change campaign starts several years later. It's obvious the motivation behind the climate change campaign. It's this transition to renewable energies. That makes sense if you're in Europe, but so the historical point is, they were several years, almost a decade into their own campaign for European energy security before they refurbished their campaign and started calling it climate change, started calling it global warming. They recruited a chunk of the scientific community to act as propagandists for them. But what is driving this is the quest for European energy independence. Europe is a very powerful player on the world scene. They have their rivalries for sure. But you can bet that as Donald Trump starts to implement his climate change agenda, relations with Europe are going to go right down the toilet bowl.
God, that is something I hadn't really thought about. When I listened to your video, I thought, oh, yeah, we don't look at that very often. Let's come back and talk about that. We've got to take a really quick break here. We're here with William Kay. He is the purveyor of the website ecofascism.com. He's got tons of information on there, too, by the way. Thank our sponsors.
Powerhouse Solar.
Trying to get Bill to talk. It's really hard.
I'm mesmerized. I got a million questions. I'm just...
We busted Bill into multitasking overload. We'll be right back. I believe they wrote a song all those years ago about exactly what happens today. That's so weird.
They were time travelers.
Exactly. Another plug for time travel. All right, William.
William, I got a question. I got to ask. You know, we're talking about it, when Trump takes office, his policies are going to raise havoc with Europe. Why couldn't why doesn't the U.S. put themselves in a position where we supply resources, oil, coal, whatever, to Europe? I mean, we've got vast quantities that we aren't even tapping. And, I mean, just the threat of that, I would think, would drop oil prices from OPEC dramatically, and everybody would be happy. I mean, doesn't make sense about that?
Well, you're not proposing that we give them fuel as some sort of charity.
But we could sell it. I mean,
a lot of people in Europe have a very low opinion of America as well. As far as they were concerned, as far as they are concerned, the United States is their number one rival. It wouldn't solve their problem. Their problem is they are hemorrhaging $500 billion a year. That money is going to the Russians and to the Arabs. To simply say, now you get to give hundreds of billions of dollars a year to the American economy. That's still an economic rival. their goal is a Europe that has nothing but electric vehicles, where those electric vehicles are powered by wind and solar, where all the wind and solar facilities are constructed on European soil. That's their goal. Their goal is true independence. Their goal is by 2040, not a single internal combustion engine on the road. Every vehicle in Europe is going to be electric, and they're going to be powered by renewable energies and by methane from garbage and what have you. They are devoted to that, simply shifting up the country upon whom they are dependent would not be deemed a solution to them. And never lose sight of the fact that there are a lot of people in the European Union, our allies in Berlin, who have a very low opinion of America.
Oh, yeah, and that's, you know, there's a whole host of reasons for that. But I've read recently that some of these European nations are kind of backing away from, you know, especially wind power and that. It's just not penciling out. I mean, they're spending billions of dollars on it.
Yeah, where's their electricity going to come from?
Well, I mean, that's what I'm saying. Why can't we give them another option?
Well, there's nothing at present preventing Americans from selling petroleum to the Europeans or selling coal to them. What you're recommending is the solution. What they should be doing, what I think, is that, you know, these wealthy German businesses and governments should be investing heavily into coal production in the United States and Canada, digging up the coal, working with joint ventures with American firms, and shipping the coal back. If they would do that, they would not be hemorrhaging as much money. Mm-hmm. But and you're right. Europe is very divided. I mean, there are some people who see this as a doomed scenario. But I'm looking at the Wind Europe website, and they are boasting that they want to have Europe 40% powered by wind in the next 20 years. Like, all electricity in Europe is going to come from wind. They're currently investing over $100 billion a year in wind construction. Over 250,000 Europeans are working just in sort of wind installment, wind construction. As far as they're concerned, this is an energy war, and they're striving for independence and energy security. And if you don't have the fossil fuels in the ground, then this is what you're going to have to do. You're making a legitimate offer, but I think in the minds of the sort of the European class, they would be just trading,
dependence.
Maybe giving money to the Americans as opposed to the Russians, and in their mind, that's not such a wonderful deal.
Hmm. Yeah, I can kind of understand that, but their options are fairly limited. I mean, when you don't have the resources, you've got to make a deal with somebody.
As the French say, we don't have oil, we have ideas.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And their big idea. Yeah. Well, it's a lot of the climate skeptics in America keep talking about how crazy this thing is. This whole global warming thing is just crazy. It's not crazy if you're in Europe, because they were in on the ground floor of this. They were developing, wind farms and solar power in the late 1970s in response to the OPEC crisis.
But is it penciling out for them? I mean, is their energy cost? It's got to be way higher than what...
Six times. Electricity is six times more expensive in Germany than America.
Why aren't the people over there recognizing that and going with a cheaper alternative?
That means, they can forget about energy independence. That means they would have to be importing gas and oil and coal from the rest of the world. It's kind of like Denmark import like 100% of their coal. They import all of their gas and all of their oil. Germany imports all of its oil. It would still be more market. In the long run, what they really fear is that if they let market trends play out as they are, Europe ultimately becomes a second tier part of the world. Mm-hmm. Not only are they going to be handing out hundreds of billions of dollars a year to their rivals, the United States, the Russians, are going to have much lower energy costs. Already, a lot of European firms are leaving Europe because electricity costs, energy costs are such an important part of doing business. It just doesn't make sense to be there anymore. And if they're relying on intermittent and highly expensive forms of electricity, it's very difficult for a lot of these big, sophisticated plants to operate. So the fear that the Europeans have is that if we simply allowed the market to do its thing, they are doomed. They are doomed to becoming sort of a second world country, whereas other parts of the world are going to race ahead. Their strategy was to transition their own economies to the non-fossil fuel sector and get in on the ground floor of those technologies. Three of the world's largest wind turbine manufacturers are in Europe. They supply about almost half of the world's turbines are being manufactured in Europe. 99% of the turbines being deployed in Europe are manufactured locally. They're having a more difficult time with solar panels because the Asians have so cut into the market. But the plan was, you know, we transition to the clean economy, the green economy. Then we try to impose this on the entire world. And then the entire world comes and buys our panels, our turbines, our biofuel digesters and what have you. This was going to be a win-win situation for them.
For them.
As opposed to hemorrhaging money buying fossil fuels, they're going to make money selling fossil fuel replacing technology.
Right. Which is great. I mean, that's a great plan if it worked, but it didn't work. And I don't think it ever will.
It's their plan.
Right.
It's a plan you would come up with if you didn't have any fossil fuels. Like, America doesn't have a shortage of coal.
No.
Europe has a shortage of coal.
Well, we certainly don't have a shortage of oil either.
Oil or natural gas or uranium.
Right.
America is a natural energy superpower.
Mm-hmm.
The whole climate change campaign was tailored to countries that don't have these things.
Right.
It also plays well in places like New York City or Los Angeles because they fear if you allow the markets to go forward, there would be a lot of migration into the heartland of America.
Mm-hmm.
Places like Wyoming and Oklahoma and Dakotas and Texas, there would be a shift in population away from the coastal areas. Once again, congregating around where the fossil fuels and energy would be the cheapest. So it kind of works. You'll see the Europeans have got allies amongst the coastal elites of America. And if you saw the last election, that was pretty obvious. But in the main sort of heartlands of America, no. This whole climate change campaign is an economic disaster.
Well,
I have a National Football League analogy.
Okay.
Do you want to hear it?
Absolutely.
Now, full disclosure, I'm not a football fan.
Hey, neither are we.
I'm a martial arts fan. But here's the analogy. The New Orleans Saints, they lead the National Football League in passing. They have the best passing team. The San Francisco 49ers are the worst. Now, if you could imagine, what if the San Francisco 49ers started to lobbying the NFL commission, say, let's phase out passing. We'll say it's destroying football. It's destroying attendance. Attendance is going down because the fans don't want to see any more forward passing. And, of course, you know, the New Orleans Saints would say, well, you guys are just saying that because your passing game sucks. And they'd say, well, are you in denial that the attendance is declining? It'd be that sort of an argument.
Right.
Like the European Union would be like the San Francisco 49ers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we can phase out fossil fuels, then we're a competitive part of the world again. If we allow the fossil fuel economy, I don't even like using the word fossil fuel, like the hydrocarbon economy, oil, coal, and natural gas. If we allow that to flourish, Europe is doomed. Europe is not going to be winning any championships. So what they are trying to do is fundamentally change the rules of the game to make themselves more competitive. And that's the small gear that turns this other gear when you realize this whole global warming thing is an absolute hoax.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's all these, you know, theories as to how, you know, of course, there's a lot of people who are aware that climate change, you know, the catastrophic, anthropogenic, global warming hypothesis is rather untenable. But where the climate skeptical community falls apart, then they try to explain, well, how does this happen? Like, how does something that's clearly scientifically dubious, and that's an understatement, how does that become the consensus? How does that become something that you have to hear about every day on the national news.
Mm-hmm.
And then they come up with all kinds of screwball conspiracy theories and mass psychology theories as to what's driving this. What it really is a form of neocolonialism. The European Union is having an effect on American culture, Canadian culture. They are, you know, there's over 500 million people living in the European Union. These are sophisticated, advanced societies, and they have a deep amount of control over the American mainstream media. And it is through that they're able to perpetrate this.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you one example of that. There's a German multinational called Bertelsmann, and it is a mass media company in Europe. It's one of Europe's biggest television networks, radio networks, puts out over 500 magazines and online offerings, what have you. But it is also the world's largest publisher of books, 15,000 new titles each year. Bertelsmann owns 250 smaller publishing companies that it makes no effort to inform the public are all centralized in Bertelsmann. About 50% of all the books, the new books being purchased in America, are coming from that company. And the family that owns that company have been involved in the Club of Rome, which is this ultra-green, ultra-environmentalist, neo-fascist group in Europe. The Mon family own 100% of the voting shares of Bertelsmann. And they are, like, you know, by quite a margin, the largest book publisher in the world, the largest publisher of English language books in the world. There's another family called the Holzbrinks from Germany. Once again, major mass media company. They put out Scientific American, Nature magazine. A lot of the pop science magazines out there are all coming from the Holzbrinks family. And once again, as with the Mullins, you know, in impeccable Nazi pedigree. These were families that were very involved in the Third Reich, in promoting propaganda in the Third and for the Third Reich, and now they are absolutely dominating book and magazine media in the United States.
Wow.
I could list several companies like that.
Let's do that.
That are European-based.
Do that in just a second. We've got to take another really quick break.
Sounds good. Do it.
And you have a really good video about that, too, by the way. So people should go to the website, wethepeopleradio.us, and it's all listed on there for you. We'll be back with William Kay in just a couple of seconds. Continue on.
We're back.
See, it was just seconds.
Okay.
I never say 2 minutes anymore. I'm just going to say seconds because it seems shorter. All right. So, the Nazis never go away, do they? Kind of funny. Everybody always likes to bring it up, and then we all tell them to, you know, don't be silly, but I guess maybe we're just not paying attention.
Fascism is sort of a shape-shifting phenomenon. It doesn't always use the same rhetoric. There are certain basic interests that keep coming out, but they're very skilled at sort of, you know, morphing and rebranding themselves and coming out a slightly different. And of course, history does not really repeat itself. It's always something new. History is very linear. What you're really seeing is sort of the European old money, the European aristocracy. They were always opposed to democracy. They were always opposed to capitalism. And they were never, driven from power. They know how to lie low periodically, and they know how to sort of resurface themselves. I'm noticing with a lot of this anti-Trump stuff, they're sure throwing the word fascism around a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And these are people who really do not know what they're talking about. If I had to pick which of those two main parties in the United States has the greatest similarities to fascism, it's undoubtedly the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of stuff on my website, because it's called Environmentalism is Fascism. Half that equation is fascism. So I have put a lot of energy over the years in reading about fascism. There's a book put out by Oxford called The Oxford Handbook on Fascism. It's about a, you know, 800-page brick. And it's sort of, this is Oxford's effort to sort of explain what fascism is. And I condensed that down with, you know, supplementation from a bunch of other encyclopedias and what have you, down to about, you know, my definition of fascism, which runs about 70, 80 pages. But, you know, what fascism was, just to go off on a tangent here, it's really the sort of political regimes you saw in Europe from the end of World War One to 1945. Of course, some of them in France and, I mean, in Spain and Portugal lasted much longer. But those regimes are not at all like Donald Trump. The old school fascists were really opposed to capitalism. They certainly weren't, you know, leftists. They didn't want to sort of expropriate the property of the rich, certainly not the landlords. But they had a vision of what they called the corporatist ethic, where it was a super regulated form of economy. They were quite opposed to democracy. I mean, you got all these people in the United States who are, you know, it sounds like they really want to overturn the results of the last election.
They keep trying.
Like, you know, they're willing to use violence to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's almost a textbook definition of fascism. I mean, time and again, what you saw in Europe is after World War One, a lot of the monarchies fell. You had this sort of democratic revolutions that had happened in Germany and Austria, and then there was this reaction where the old guard tried to reimpose themselves upon, you know, the system, and to retake the state away from the democratically elected government. That is what you've seen, you know, and then there are several countries around the world since then. But that's classic fascism. You know, it really comes from the oligarchy, the old money, the wealthiest sort of landlords from the aristocracy. They despise the lower classes. They don't think that, you know, there's at least, you know, fascists will say things like, you know, the common people are just too ignorant and too stupid to understand financial policy or foreign policy. So why are we even asking their opinion?
Boy, who's that
sound really,
like?
They really, at a fundamental level, don't believe in democracy. They believe in sort of having the sort of old clique of the first families running the whole show. And that's what you saw in Europe, and in country after country. There was an opening to democracy, and then the door just got slammed shut, and you had, you know, Mussolini in Italy and Hitler in Germany. And there were 24 different fascist dictatorships across Europe, you know, from the gates of Moscow to the White Cliffs of Dover. You know, by 1941, every country in Europe had a fascist dictator.
Well,
and
see,
there were several million people who were members of fascist political parties, and maybe 200 of them got hung in Nuremberg.
Yeah.
Well, these guys here talk about fascism. You know, they call somebody a fascist because they don't like them. They really don't. They're not matching any kind of ideology. It's just, if you're a bad person, you're Hitler.
It's got nothing to do with.
Oh, I don't know where their brains are really at. There's a lot of people who have, you know, basically been brainwashed or, I don't know, seriously indoctrinated. The universities are in many ways the main culprits of this. But what you see every time there is a fascist movement, there's sort of this mass goon squad of people who all they got is the talking points, and that's about it. But they can be quite dangerous and violent. So I'm definitely going to be tuned in on the inauguration day. I had the sort of timeline. It's only like 4 days, and, you know, here we are. I've got it. 4 days, 20 hours, 14 minutes, and 8 seconds until the inauguration. But it would not surprise me at all to see, you know, blood in the streets.
Oh, no. I think this is going to be a real huge wake-up call for a lot of people. But, you know, William, I want to get back to one thing. We kind of left it for a minute there. As far as the EU is concerned and fossil fuels versus renewable energy, what would be the ramifications if, if the United States said, hey, you know what, we're going to become self-reliant on fossil fuels. We've got all we need. We can sustain ourselves for hundreds of years. We really don't need any more of this BS coming out of Europe. If you guys want to get on board, and I think maybe not just the United States, but North America, include Canada. Canada's in the same position. I mean, they've got huge natural resources. If North America, you know, just got together and said, hey, we're gonna play our own energy game, and if you guys want to be included, great. If not, you know, you do your thing, we'll do ours. What would happen? I mean, we're looking at World War III if something like that really came to pass.
Nicolas Sarkozy, who was the former president of France, who is running again for the presidency of France, has already said, as soon as Trump got elected, he's said that Europe must impose carbon tariffs on all goods imported from the United States. Like, we're going to impose climate tariffs on all of your goods. And he's not some fringe guy. He is one of the most influential figures in France right now. And there's a lot of other European leaders who are of the same sort of view, that they are going to penalize and punish America if America does not play ball on the climate front.
But that's really kind of a hollow – isn't that kind of a hollow threat, really? I mean, yeah, we're in a position right now where we're importing probably more than we ever have. We don't really manufacture that much here. I mean, I know we have, you know – businesses here that make cars overseas and so forth. But, I mean, most of our goods, let's face it, come from China, Japan. The EU isn't really that – we aren't going to get hurt that much market-wise if they – I mean, they would get hurt more than we would, wouldn't they?
Well, they're the ones who are the targets. I'm looking at it right now. American exports to the EU, $495 billion. So it's fairly substantial still. It would hurt. We could sort of live without them, but it's sort of that deteriorating relationship. I mean, even in the United States, if the Trump administration, and if you look at his cabinet, there are four people there who are pretty obviously climate skeptics. Add Trump, he got five, mm-hmm. You know, and the guys he has in charge of the EPA, the interior, energy, these guys are all climate skeptics.
Right.
So if they do the right thing and just drop a lot of these regulations, there is going to be turmoil in America. You know, you in America, there are tens of thousands of people working in the wind industry, et cetera. Biofuels, there's a lot of farmers who are growing corn to turn into ethanol. If not for the regulations that the government is imposing on that, they'll have to go back to growing food again. I'm saying there's going to be some adjustment here.
Okay, yeah, but I think a lot of that could be offset. Can't a lot of that be offset by just easing the regulations and let them grow food and export it? I mean, there's a lot of countries out there that would love to, you know, import our groceries.
But it's not win-win. I mean, if they said, okay, we're going to drop any of this requirement that you add ethanol to your fuel, it's a big chunk. It's about half of the corn market right now is going into ethanol. Those farmers would be upset. They're not going to starve to death, but they're going to take a hit. The consumers would benefit because food prices would fall. I'm all for that. Like, you know, I think it's one of the worst things that climate change has done is to support this whole biofuels industry, because we're basically telling farmers to grow a harvest. We're paying them more than the market would pay, and we're burning it.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
That's just an outrage.
It is.
I'm all for eliminating any sort of subsidies to biofuels, but let's not pretend that that's going to be popular in certain states.
Right. No, that'll be a big fight.
That's going to be a financial hit. Yep. Okay, so apply that to Europe. I mean, the climate industries, the climate industrial complexes, biofuels, wind power, you know, all the smart meters and the fast chargers for the electric cars and that, this is a huge industrial complex. Any politician in Europe says, okay, forget it. You know, let's just drop all this crap and move on to something else. It would be, you know, 10 times worse than trying to pitch, you know, the end of ethanol in Iowa. I don't think this is something that Europe can, it's too big to fail, right? It's something that they can really stop and do something else. You and I can come up with better ideas for Europe as to how they might meet their energy needs in the future. But this is something that's so deeply entrenched and so big in Europe, I don't think they can turn it around. And I think they're going to develop a very hostile attitude towards the United States if the United States does the right thing and walks away from this whole malarkey.
Right. But, you know, also I think we have to consider that the EU is in trouble. I mean, there's a lot of countries over there now thinking, you know what, this isn't working for us. And, you know, Britain's out. There was somebody else talking about bailing,
France
too.
France are talking about
yeah,
it.
France, yeah. If the EU does fall apart, these countries are going to be back on an even footing where they can make their own deals with foreign governments on their energy. They're not going to be hamstrung by all these regulations and power brokers in the EU. So, I mean, that's a big factor as well.
It is. This could end up breaking the EU.
Which I don't think would be a bad thing.
More. Oh, I would support it completely.
Mm-hmm.
In Europe right now, there are 97 million people who speak German, first language. Of course, it's the Federal Republic of Germany. It's Austria. It's most of Switzerland. Basically, Liechtenstein, Luxembourg. Around them, there's a cluster of states, most notably Denmark and Sweden, Slovenia and Croatia, that are completely integrated into the German-speaking world. And their collective numbers are probably about 120 million. That is the Fourth Reich. And what we saw with Brexit, that was the Second Battle of Britain. That was Britain breaking away from a very much German-dominated EU. France is seriously talking about breaking away from a very German-dominated EU. But what you're left with then is, you know, this basically Fourth Reich. Well, what it ends up looking like are the battle lines of World War One, the
yes.
battle lines
yes.
of World War Two.
Yes.
And to the east, there is this centuries-old competition between the German-speaking realm and the Russian-speaking realm, and the poor bastards who were stuck in between them.
Yep. It always comes back to Germany.
And the crushing will begin. One more quick break before the top of the hour. We're going to come back with our guest, William Kay. We've got a whole nother hour with him. We roped him into two. Thanks, William. You're
no
listening
problem.
To We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Every time we stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
William, we have like
yeah,
2 minutes till the top of the hour. Are you just, like, enjoying the music today? Because I'm sorry, but Bob's killing it.
He's always good. He's always on the ball, that guy. It's rare to have a...
Allentown was awesome.
...studio guy that actually listens to the show.
Yeah, listens to the show, pays attention, and knows music that was written before 2014. We had a guy once. We had a substitute guy who was an engineer, and we asked him to play a song, and he looked at us like we were...
Yeah.
You know, and it was like Steely Dan.
What movie was that from?
It was like Steely Dan or something. We're like, what? You don't even know that? I guess all we really have time for is to give people a little sneak preview on what are we going to talk about next hour?
I'd like to go back
so they don't get bored.
Back to the beginning.
Well, you're William, but we call
no
you
worries,
Bill.
Man.
Oh,
no
sorry.
Worries. I can.
Oh, I know in one of your videos
I've got a few topics I can kick up here.
Well, in one of your videos I was listening to you talk about the Earth's climate has been changing since the beginning. So we can't argue
well, if
that
you
there...
want to get into the science, yeah, I could talk about that for another 2 hours.
Oh, yeah.
I do like the EU thing, though.
Oh, God,
can we do more on that?
I want to make a few few more points. I haven't really brought in the whole Russian thing yet, which is what I was trying to do.
Sorry.
when we started. But any sort of science question on climate, yeah, like I've been reading about this topic now for over 20 years.
I was hoping never to have to read about it, but now we all have to get smart about it.
We all have to be experts.
Well, now it's going to get really, really interesting. Now there's actually going to be a debate in American society.
Oh.
We've never had that before.
That's true. That's true, because we've all been just labeled as haters.
Yeah, so you know, there's this intercom in the corner that's just, you know, that's half the debate, and we don't get to respond to it.
Right, right. The science is settled. I love those people. They come into my office periodically. The science is settled. I'm like, you know, just by virtue of the fact that it's science, it can't be settled.
Mm-hmm.
Or it shouldn't be settled.
Oh, it's pretty much settled now that people understand that global warming is an absolute hoax. Yeah, that's the emerging consensus.
See,
certainly in the Republican Party.
I should have you hang out at work with me one day.
Answer the phones.
We would have so much fun. All right, we're going to be back for the next hour with William Kay. We'll try to get our breaks on time so we don't have them all crammed at the end. Sorry about that. Thanks to our sponsor, Powerhouse Solar. And you're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.